This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
I banked on the fact that everyone else would tell you what's in the book, which they did, and so now I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try and sort of take a step back, which I can only really do because everyone else has done the hard work for me. And there. And I wanted to open with a quote that I'm going to come back to that hopefully many of you will have heard, though I'm betting that many of you will have only heard one fragment of it. And that is a quote from John Maynard Keynes, where he says, in 1924, in the long run, we are all dead. How many people have heard that quote? Like a lot of people, right? In the long run, we all dead. The full quote goes something to the effect, this is from memory, in the long run, we are all dead. Economists do very little for us if they tell us that after the storm, the ocean will be calm again. That's how the whole quote goes, though he says it way cooler than I did. But I want you to keep that in your head because it's going to kind of come back. And I won't have to repeat it then. So from what you've already heard, you know that Piketty's argument is basically, I would say, what I call an or else argument. Via R is greater than G, this cumulative force over time, capitalism is producing a level of inequality that, in his words, this is a quote, is very unlikely to be accepted. Fix it or else. That's the message that the book gives us. Now, I want to focus on this specifically. If R is greater than G means capitalism, or even, I would say, civilization as a whole, according to Piketty, is at risk, then what exactly is it at risk of? What is the or else? And who is the unaccepting whoever out there? It turns out, of course, no surprise to most of you, I'm sure, maybe to nobody, that this problem has a very long history. And I believe it's really important to put Piketty in some historical context. And that's what I'm going to do. And that's why I have this cool art. Because neither his questions nor his answers are novel. I think this history provides the best way to understand why a 700-page economics book, 950 in French, I might mention, that's because when we say not, they say ne pas, so it takes way longer. A 700-page economics book is a bestseller and the hottest topic on the blogosphere worldwide, at least in English and often in French and Spanish too. That kind of thing just doesn't happen because you have a good argument or you're a good writer. So, let's begin. This is, many of you will know this from high school, I hope. This is William Hogarth's Gin Lane from 1751. In the early stages of what we would now call the capitalist era. The etching may be familiar, as I said. I remember learning of it in high school when I was told, I have no idea if this is true, that in this era, poor parents would often nurse their children on gin because it was cheaper than milk. Now, I have no idea, as I said, if that's true. But Hogarth's anxiety suffuses this piece, I would say. There's, of course, condescension here, but there's a lot of anxiety. This is the modern world. This is what modern society is producing, this world. And that, the production part of this, is a crucial idea to what I want to say here. This is not the world that modern urban commercial society is erasing. This is the one it's making. This is new. Civil society, that's the term that was used at the time, and still used today by many, the private realm of the economy, public life outside the state, this is producing a social disaster for many. You can feel the dread in this, from this terrible development, I would say. Many of you will have heard of this guy too, Adam Smith. Two decades later, after Hogarth, he publishes The Wealth of Nations, 1776, blah, blah, blah. Smith, of course, also had a theory of civil society, but one that's far more optimistic, as many of you will know, based, as all theories always are, and this is going to be really important to my point, though it's obvious, based, as all theories always are, in the world in which he lived. He was witness to an extraordinary explosion in commerce and in the emergence of new non-state realms of economic activity. He saw the modern world of private enterprise as tending to produce more and more wealth and more opportunity. I should mention, I have chosen these, I am no art scholar, that may be obvious already, but I have chosen these pieces because I think they kind of communicate the feeling that I get from reading these works. So I'm not, these aren't endorsements of this work. If there's something bad about some of these, you can just ignore it for now. So Smith didn't use the word, but capitalist markets come out of his account looking pretty good. He described a smooth circular flow of goods and money between landlords, producers, and workers that was basically a virtuous circle. There are some things that markets don't do well, he said, like supplying armies or building bridges, but in general, there are a few seeds of destruction in modern economic development. Now, in these two images, we have, in oversimplified form, certainly, two ideas of what capitalism and market-organized society can do and where they lead, or where it leads, to gin lane or to a businessman's paradise. These two theories continue to struggle for our hearts and minds, and many people, I think, have them struggling within them all the time, every day. Others, of course, thought Hogarth was right, but saw a lot of light at the end of that tunnel. Perhaps the most famous of these others, and I think often the most misunderstood, is Marx himself. Marx, of course, had a theory of civil society as well, based in the thought of others, but developed for the world around him, a world of increasingly intense exploitative industrialization. Millions of men, women, and children working all day, every day, for almost nothing, living in squalor and with no prospect of escape, no means to make a living without continuing to sell their bodies to capitalists for a daily wage. Now, Marx argued that capital's monopoly over the means of production, in combination with market competition, crucial, produced two tendencies. First, toward increasing dispossession and exploitation of non-capitalist elements in the economy, including labor, and second, toward the reduction of profits. At some point, and it is not at all clear when, and Marx, of course, never claimed to know when, the social bonds holding the system together will no longer hold. Marx argued that a similar emerging tension between the needs of society and the way it organized its economy had led to the end of every other mode of production, and it would seem quite reasonable to expect the same would be true of capitalism. Of course, he was not so disappointed at this prospect. He saw capitalism's seeds of destruction as also seeds of a new era. In fact, he once wrote to Engels during the financial panic of 1857, the long-forgotten financial panic of 1857, saying that he liked to visit the stock market these days because it was one of the few things that made him bounce with joy. He really used the word bounce. I mean, the German version of it, which I don't know, but that was the translation I read. Anyway, so let's bounce forward a few decades in this, which is the fastest history of ever of economics, to John Maynard Keynes, who was born the same year Karl Marx died, 1883. Now, one might say that at the broadest level, Keynes' understanding of market-based civil society combined elements of Smith's and Marx's. Like Smith, Keynes saw markets and private property-based civil society as the motor of production of wealth and as the best possible means by which to realize economic progress. But he also saw the flaws inherent in the capitalist system if left to self-regulate. Like his forebears, Keynes' thinking was completely shaped by the world around him. In this case, interwar Europe and England. He understood that world, which seemed to him and many others like one continuous disaster, as a logical outcome of half a century of high liberalism, free trade, privatization, unregulated markets, a system often called laissez-faire, which most of you probably know what it means, but just in case you don't, it basically means let civil society do as it will. Keynes said this freedom might have enriched some, but it had left many behind and then killed itself. World War I, the rise of fascisms during the strife of the 1920s, then the Depression and the emergence of Nazism, these were all the products of laissez-faire, market-organized, in Keynes's terms, individualistic capitalism. Now, capitalism might be good at producing wealth, he said, but it was not good at distributing it, nor was it good at dealing with uncertainty. And uncertainty was inescapable and only made the distributional questions harder to solve. When people are feeling uncertain, they tend to hoard or at least not to invest and consume, a process that, of course, starts a vicious cycle with which we are very familiar. Investment was the biggest problem of all. Uncertainty about the future means that we can never guarantee an adequate or steady flow of investment, and investment is what produces employment. If it slows or stops, so too does the flow of available opportunities and income. Keynes believed that the world around him taught him very clearly where mass impoverishment, joblessness, and inequality led to fascism, Stalinism, and war. This is where the world leads in this situation. As Keynes saw it, this inevitable trajectory on which laissez-faire runs and the roller coaster it put modern economies on was only avoidable if it was managed, he said, and only the state has the capacity to do that. And in contrast to what many think of when they think of Keynesianism, which is usually like the welfare state and fiscal policy or whatever, Keynes actually, in the book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, says that the best way to do this is to use monetary policy to encourage employment-based investment. The problem, however, and this is where we get to Piketty, the problem, however, was that the interest rate, according to Keynes, the return to buying debt, which confusingly Keynes calls R, which screws everything up, the interest rate was often higher than what Keynes called the marginal efficiency of capital, which is to say the profit rate an entrepreneur could hope to make or expect to make by a productive investment in things that would actually give people jobs. If the interest rate that anyone with money can get from buying, if the interest rate that anyone with money can get from buying bonds or sitting on deposits beats the return you can get from it investing in stuff that employs people, then they're going to do that, but we're also then therefore going to find ourselves on precisely the road of self-destruction to which high liberalism had led, a creaking rent-dependent aristocracy and international aggression. This is what Keynes saw as the product of liberalism in its purest form. In other words, Keynes says that the problem is the inequality, R is greater than our MEC, marginal efficiency of capital, and it is better to be a renter than an entrepreneur, unless the state steps in. Since the state cannot guarantee a certain return on productive investment, the one thing it can do is keep the interest rate low, so productive investment looks like the better option. If so, then capitalist animal spirits, which is a famous term he used, I love that, animal spirits will be very sprightly and investment will flow. Keynes' most famous work, where he lays this theory out, is called, as I said, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. It appeared in 1936 and was greeted with a very familiar level of debate, celebration, and derision. Piketty would be familiar with this feeling. Now, at this point, you won't be surprised to hear me say that Piketty has essentially written what I think is a general theory for our times. The inequality R is greater than G tells us that, barring the exceptional period after World War II, it is almost always better to be a renter than an entrepreneur. And it is not, but this is not good for capitalism's legitimacy. The difference between R is greater than the marginal efficiency of capital, Keynes, and R is greater than G, Piketty, is largely a product of history. In Keynes's day, with the smell of aristocracy still in the air, the distinction between productive and unproductive parts of the economy was pretty much taken for granted. In fact, Keynes called R unearned income. Not a term we hear much these days. Now we call it capital gains. Piketty collapses marginal efficiency of capital into his R because the distinction between rent and income from productive investment has become a lot blurrier in our financialized era, an era in which vast pools of mobile international capital flow toward the highest yield, regardless of its source or its means of producing it. When a manufacturing corporation, this is a standard story, when a manufacturing corporation like Ford uses its profits to invest in debt-backed securities to increase the dividends it pays to hedge fund managers who then return those profits to their investors, it's very difficult to tell where the line between rent and legitimate, real profit lies. Ultimately, as Piketty shows, this blurrier R also tends to beat the returns to growth. And that, in the end, is a big problem, because it accelerates inequality, and thus, literally, if you read the book, and those of you who have read this, hopefully will agree, the idea is that literally it puts civilization at risk. At risk, I think, from precisely those same things that Keynes was afraid of: violence, disorder, fascism. Literally, those are the specters behind this book. Like Keynes, Piketty thinks that we can do very little to alter G, the rate of growth, and the best we can do, just like Keynes said, is to lower R. But since he feels we cannot divide capital any longer into a good productive investment and bad parasitic rentier categories, tax is the mode. Messing with the rate of interest won't work anymore. And after 6 years of rates near zero and skyrocketing profits and inequality, clearly he has a point. The only way to effectively lower R is a global tax on capital, which Marjorie covered in great detail, which is great. If we refuse to take something like this on, the world is headed in a dark direction, Piketty says. So, like Keynes, Piketty's great or else is drawn from the world around him, increasingly unequal, increasingly undemocratic, and increasingly precarious. It is plagued with political and economic fragmentation. Decades of geopolitical order seem to be coming unstuck. We have right-wing populisms in supposedly faithful parts of the liberal core of the world, France, for example. And then all of this is backed by environmental and atmospheric decay. Anxiety and trepidation are widespread, and Piketty makes a lot of sense in that world. And this world is anxious in the same way that the world was when Keynes published The General Theory in 1936. So for Piketty and Keynes, it doesn't matter a whit if pure liberalism is truer or morally superior to other principles of social organization. Those questions are moot if it renders the very foundations of social order unstable. If free market utopianism makes any sense at all, Piketty and Keynes say, it is only in the long run, and in the long run, we, those of us who have to go to work tomorrow, are all dead. As Keynes himself said 1 year later in 1937 to clarify this, we do not know what the future will bring, except that it will be quite different from anything we could predict. I have said in another context that it is a disadvantage of the long run that in the long run we are all dead. But I could equally well have said that it is a great advantage of the short run that in the short run we are all alive. History and life are made up of short runs. If we are at peace in the short run, that is something. The best we can do is put off disaster. If only in the hope, which is not necessarily a remote one, that something will turn up. This, I believe, is the reason we're all here tonight. This is why this book matters right now, because this is why people so desperately seek to know that there is a reason, there is something that can be done. And part of the problem, of course, is what Piketty and Keynes both tell us, is that we don't have to do much. A tax on capital, it doesn't take a lot. We can tweak this system and it'll work for everybody. But the bigger question doesn't get addressed, which is, can with a little bit of fiscal ballast, can we right this capitalist ship? Neither of them ask that question, and that's because that's a much scarier question to ask, but that's the one we also need to be asking at the same time. Thank you very much.